Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, February 3rd, 2022, in the ongoing series this year, 2022. My show, I will be doing the history, basically, of my discoveries and weaving them in and with anecdotes about things that happened to me and places I went and people that I talked to or whatever it was. In my basically kind of a mini history of my life here. And first of all, I want to make a correction. It was last week I was talking about my being at Cornell University. My first semester there was in the physics department. The next three semesters I was in the math department. But anyway, during my relatively early in my first semester there with the physics department, Doug Fitchin, the chairman of the physics department, called me in, and he was very angry at me because I was using Cornell's name to publish my papers, which were proving basically NASA theories incorrect using NASA data. And one of the things he did is he said, I can't fire you. Excuse me. He said, I can't fire you. I need you to teach because I was involved in coursework. And it was not a problem with my teaching. It was because I was publishing my work. And it was not seen favorably. But anyway, he assigned a woman from the physics department, a professor there, from the physics department to follow me around and be in class with me whenever I was with students to prevent me from talking to students about my work. And so anyway, last week what I said was this lady's name was Robinson, and it really, that was an error. I want to correct that. Her name was Betty Richardson, Dr. Betty Richardson. And if you look at the record at Cornell, she was involved in some textbooks writing at Cornell. And so anyway, it was Dr. Betty Richardson who was the one who was designated to follow me around when I was on campus, and she did. When I was on campus, there was Betty. And, I don't think she followed me when I came on campus in the morning, but I was not allowed to talk to students about anything except their coursework that I was, you know, in their course. It was an electronics course, and then it was like physics. There were some laboratories involved. I remember Betty being there, and the students would ask her questions too, not knowing that her job was not to answer questions. She was just there to observe me and to keep me from taking students aside and talking to them about my work. I mean, that's how paranoid these people were. And typically, I wouldn't have gone around talking to students anyway. I didn't know it was a big deal. I'm just publishing my theoretical work in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. And it just wouldn't occur to me to go around and try and drum up problems with students by trying to tell them that what I was working on. I thought, you know, wouldn't even cross my mind to do that, but they were so paranoid that I would somehow talk to students about this that Dr. Betty Richardson was designated to follow me around when I was on campus. When I went to eat, there was Betty. When I went back to class in the afternoon or something, there was Betty. When I left campus, then Betty would stop trailing me for the day. Next day, go back to school. Whenever I walked in that classroom, there's Betty. Follow me around. I mean, seriously. Anyway, I wanted to correct it because I had said it was Mrs. Robinson, and it was not. It was Betty Richardson, Dr. Betty Richardson. I'm just going to insert a few other comments here because for the last few weeks I was talking about the time I spent in Mexico City. And just a little detail, I lived in the area of Tacubaya, southwestern corner of the city. It's kind of up in the foothills because Mexico City is basically built in the caldera of a giant, ancient extinct volcano. When the Aztecs lived there, it was a lake, and they had built causeways around in the lake, and they grew rice there or corn. I don't know what all the, you know, their crops. But the Aztecs had a complete, and they had monuments, etc. It was interesting when you would ride the subway in Mexico City. It's still there, of course, now. The subway was French built, a very beautiful subway system, the most modern in the world, really, at the time. Next to the subway in Paris, it was modeled after the Paris subway, because, of course, Mexico City at that time was the largest city in the world, 10 million population. But the and you would go through the subway and stop at these stops, and they had, in the process of digging up the subway, the tunnels, they would come across these Aztec ruins that were there, and they had literally encased in glass in some of these subway stations, the Aztec ruins that were underground, which had been lost, you know, since the Spanish had arrived. Okay, so anyway, I lived in the southwest corner of the city in an apartment on the top floor. So I guess in a sense one could call it a penthouse. It was only 5 stories tall, but anyway, the windows of my bedroom, which was basically the entire wall, there was a short hip wall, and then the entire wall was a window, and looked east across the city. So I'm in the southwest corner of the city, looking out this full wall window over Mexico City, which at night was just aglow with, it was amazing. It would look like you were living on another planet someplace, this massive city of 10 million people in the bowl of this crater. And then on the far side of the city were the two volcanoes, Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl, named after the man and the woman who were in Aztec legend. And at the time, the volcanoes were dormant. They have since become a bit active. And that's been in the news. And then, of course, there was the great Mexico City earthquake, which I was not there for, thank goodness, when the angel at downtown, the Glorieta, which has the big angel at the top, fell over, and a lot of damage to Mexico City. But I was not there during that time. I was there in the early 1970s, and teaching, and I taught had a physical job that I went to every day as a teacher, teaching science and mathematics, and then I also tutored the very rich kids, or the families, the kids of very wealthy people there. And these people were wealthy, fabulously wealthy. You would go into like the house, had a private theater, had a den where the dad would have his guns and African head mounts of elephants and rhinoceroses. And this room is big enough to have all of these African game animals with the gun that shot the animal mounted there, etc. I mean, this was Mexico City opulence at the time. But I tutored the kids. And the parents liked me because I also, a lot of these kids living in that situation were very cloistered, and they had very little outside contact. And I just offered some kind of a contact for these students. Because their parents were some of the wealthiest people in the world, literally. Mexico City does have a lot of extremely wealthy people there, in spite of the vast poverty that there exists. And these were heads of corporations, government officials from around the world, etc. And I tutored their kids. And so I would go up to their houses. The guard would let me in. And I would tutor them, and typically mathematics was the main thing I was tutoring. But it also was interesting to see the opulent lifestyle of these people. And then when I traveled around the country, every weekend I was in my vehicle traveling around Mexico and looking at ruins, etc. But the point I wanted to make is that every morning I would wake up, and the sun would come up over the volcanoes at the east side of the city, and I would mark on my windowsill the line of the direction of the sun. So I basically created a sun calendar on my windowsill in my bedroom there, looking over the city. And, of course, it went back and forth, north and south, as the winter and summer dates changed, making a solar calendar. But anyway, another incident I wanted to talk about was one time I went down to Oaxaca. I was on my way to Oaxaca to visit the ruins. There are a lot of ruins in Oaxaca. And then also just to see the culture there. The culture is very interesting. But I pulled over in an area to sleep. It was like dark. And that's typically what I would do on a Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I would get in my truck. I had a backpack, kind of like a go bag almost, and or bug out bag, some people call them, but it was just already packed and ready to go. Just grab that, get in my vehicle and go. And late at night, I pulled into this region off of the highway, and there's nobody around, nothing there. So I went to sleep. I woke up in the morning and I was at Monte Alban, which is an Aztec, one of the southernmost Aztec ruins. And it predates the actually modern Aztecs by quite a bit. But Monte Alban is a astronomical site. So a lot of these places that I visited, and there, when I walked around Monte Alban that day, I got up, got out of my vehicle, walked around, and Monte Alban, I was the only person there. I was literally the only person there. And so I had the whole day to meander there and look around and study the ruins. And it's built on a little bit of a plateau with a very good view of the surrounding countryside for miles and miles around. So you can see why they built it there. But the it was an astronomical site with astronomical significance, as were many of them, say Palenque or some of the other sites. Or Chichen Itza certainly had a... what's interesting about Chichen Itza is that it is dedicated to the planet Venus. Now, here you have a city that's 13.5 degrees off true north and south by our today's reckoning. It's 13.5 degrees off of true north and south. So it was built on the old grid system before the pole shift. But the interesting thing is that the modern city that we see today that's been reconstructed by archaeologists is built on the old gridwork. And that's when I was doing my survey there of Uxmal, Tulum, Chichen Itza, Palenque, and the various other Mayan cities in the Yucatan region, Quintana Roo, Yucatan. When I went back, this was years later, when I was at, in the early 1990s, I went back there to survey, and I took surveying equipment, transits, and all the equipment that went with it. And shot the North Star, so I had true north with my equipment, and then surveyed. What I realized is that when I took the survey lines of true of the gridwork that the cities were built on, they crossed in a point that was up around Hudson Bay, north of the state of Michigan in Ontario. And today there is a lot of work going on. It's ongoing. There's a guy named Hapgood who talked about Earth having a tremendous difficult time, catastrophic events, and that the old North Pole, by his reckoning, was in Hudson Bay. I made the same determination. There's a guy named Mark Carlotto. I think I'm saying his name right, Carlotto, who's been doing some work on the same area. And then Mark Gaffney, who's written a book, and I didn't really co-author. I worked with Mark in writing that book. We went back for probably a year or so, and right now we're in another exchange where Mark Gaffney is writing another book. And so anyway, this is very instrumental, because once again, here I am in 1971, driving down the road in the middle of the dark, pull over into a place, I don't even know where I'm at, it's just a place, a big area I can pull into and sleep for the night. I wake up the next morning, I'm in Monte Alban, one of the classic astronomical sites of the Aztecs, or like I say, pre-Aztecs. this is the kind of thing that happened throughout my life, is that I just, like, of all the places to pull over, I pull over exactly in Monte, right in the ruins area with my vehicle, sleep there. I wake up in the morning, and there I am at Monte Alban. Like I say, somebody was guiding me. And then, but I also wanted to mention a very unique place where I lived when I was in Mexico City was in this fifth floor apartment building that overlooked Mexico City. Just an unbelievable, I mean, you can't even describe in words. Mexico City is unique in that it's built in this bowl, so you see the entire city, and it's all lit up like a Christmas tree. It's an amazing sight. Anyway, also I have here in my notes a correction that I wanted to make. It's, I believe it in early in the this year when I started talking about my history, I talked about the fact that I had gotten an appointment my first year in college, appointment to the Naval Academy, and I turned it down. The day I was supposed to go, somebody took me aside, the leader of the school band that I was in at my the college where I was going in physics, math major, a private Catholic men's school, college. And anyway, I said at the time, now this was like 1960, oh, maybe 66 in that time frame. And so I said at the time that I really didn't know much about the Vietnam War and that there really wasn't a lot of activity at the college. Later that changed. Within the next couple of years, there was a tremendous amount of activity all over the, all especially in universities, college settings, where the students were very affected, of course, because of the draft, the requirement that through a lottery or through a picking of your name, you would be the one sent off to war. And, of course, those were some pretty turbulent times. But in the thing I was going to mention, at the college I was at, there was a group of people that became involved in the draft resistance. And event on September 24th, 1968, which, like I say, was a couple of years later, there was a group of people, some of them who I knew personally, that broke into the Milwaukee government building and took out all the draft records and took them over to a corner in Milwaukee and burned them. And of course, they were arrested, and I was not involved myself. I didn't know anything about it other than hearing about it afterwards and knowing some of the people that were involved in it. But that was some of the activism that resulted after the conscious level arose or was raised. And like I say, by that time, I had already personally gotten my own conscientious objector status from my own draft board in a little town where I grew up. I had gotten my official conscientious objector status and was counseling other people about the horrific nature of the war, the as much as we knew about it at the time. Of course, in retrospect, we know a lot more right now. But I wanted to clarify that the college, my comment was a couple of weeks ago, that I didn't know anything about this, and I was surprised that the colleges were not more involved in teaching the students about the reality of the Vietnam War. And then I thought afterwards, well, really, the colleges were involved, but it just didn't come out till about another year or so later. And so that was my point of bringing that up. I'm going to kind of jump around here a little bit. Now, a number of years later, after I left Mexico, I came back and I got my master's degree at Tulane University, and then I went out of the country again. And when I did that, I had a teaching position in a foreign language for 4 years, and that's why I earned my title professor. By the way, people call me professor, and some people have criticized me saying that I incorrectly call myself professor, which is a title. It's an earned title, like doctor, like like a nurse or like anything else. A professor is a title. And if I had not earned it by some other means legally, people would still call me the professor. But I did, in fact, earn the professor title when I was at that university for 4 years. And so, and in those days, you have to understand, people will say, well, you don't have a PhD. How could you be a professor? Well, in those days, not everybody had a PhD. And most of those comments come from people that weren't even born at the time we're talking about, the early 1970s. Mid-1970s, let's say. It was very common for people with master's degree to be teaching in the college level, because PhDs, the volumes of the overproduction of PhDs did not come until later. But at any rate, the point I wanted to make is, in that time, I had an interest in sailboats. I lived on the coast, on the ocean. And so anyway, I became interested in a particular style of boats called wooden boats. And of course, they had the wooden boats there. It was a region where sailboats would come in that were sailing, cruising the world, would stop in the area there. And, you know, there was a lot of camaraderie with the people with the boats, because they were from all different countries, and it was always interesting to see the new people come in and then them leave and then other new people come in. But I had my own boat. I had a boat myself. And the first boat that I had was a native fishing sloop, a wooden boat with a wooden mast and cotton sails, the canvas sails, and it was a gaff rig sailboat. Okay, now this is, by the way, the reason I'm telling you this is clearly going to lead into something that I did decades later. And once again, somebody was saying, okay, here, you do this. And it was something I just had an interest in. I was raised around boats, being from Minnesota, around the water, and especially canoes, but this was my first attempt at having a boat that would actually go in the ocean. So anyway, now the reason I'm mentioning gaff-rigged is because this comes into play later in my life. The gaff rig is where, if you look at it, a typical modern sailboat today, you see the mast and you see the rigging, the stays coming down, typically stainless steel. On these boats, it was like a galvanized steel cable that was the rigging. The earlier boats actually had rope rigging. But the gaff rig, the top triangle of the sail is cut off. It's not there, and you have another boom that comes out, and the sail attaches to that. And the reason that sailors used that is because it did not give as much, it didn't cause the boat to heel over as much. You didn't have that top little piece, which doesn't provide you with that much lift in terms of making the boat go forward. But it provides a tremendous amount of torque or force on the boat, making it heel over. And if you're in a place like, the Caribbean or the Pacific, out in the middle of the ocean, where you have tremendous amounts of wind all the time, you don't need that extra little sail up there. So the gaff rig was favored by people who had work boats. And they were out there working, and they didn't want the boat heeling way over. They wanted it to go forward. So anyway, the gaff rig is a style of sail made for work boats. Okay, well, that's important. That comes into play much later in my life. And so after the native fishing boat, I sat down and I got very interested in boat design. So I picked up all of the boat design books. I subscribed to Wooden Boat Magazine, you know, and these people are real avid, you know, I mean, this is kind of their life. And so I learned about boat building, boat design, boat construction. And when you're building a boat, it's something very particular. It's not like building a piece of furniture or a house or anything else, which is static. A boat is working. It's out in the ocean being pounded by waves, being thrown this way by the wind. It has to be constructed in a very specific manner or it won't work. It'll come apart. And so anyway, the end result is that I sat down and designed a sailboat. Now, I didn't design a sailboat from scratch, being my first attempt. It's what a lot of people do is they take a design that already exists. And so I took a design and I had a much of a favor for double enders, a boat that has, it looks like it could go either direction, even though it has a rudder on one end. It looks like the bow is on the front and on the back. And typically boats have like a flat back and a kind of like an aerodynamic front bow, they call it, that breaks into the waves. And so anyway, a double ender has kind of a bow shape at both ends, although the rear end is usually a bit more bulbous for flotation purposes. But at any rate, I chose a double ender design. It was the Tahiti Ketch is the name of that. You can look that up. And a very famous boat that wasn't the fastest boat in the world, but it came from a line of offshore work boats up in the northeastern part of the United States, which, of course, was a derivative of other boats that were built in Norway and Europe, etc. And the Scandinavian countries, double-enders were common because they're, and also gaff-rigged because they're out in work boats. But the Tahiti Ketch was a cruising sailboat of 30 feet long and very heavy-duty, very slow. And if you've been around these kind of boats in the ocean, they're just like, they're slower, but they're more stable. And in rough conditions, they do much better, etc. Very big, heavy keel on it. But the reason I'm talking about this, first of all, the gaff rig sails, and then designing this sailboat is because what I did is I didn't want to build a 30-foot sailboat. I did not want to, I mean, this is a major, like, five-year effort to build a boat like that by yourself. And so I made it 20 feet long. Now, when you do that, I'm going to use the term here, and it's called scaling. Scaling. S-C-A-L-I-N-G. And so what that means, now, like, say you had a jet airplane, and you wanted to make it bigger or smaller. Okay, you just don't make it proportionally bigger or smaller. There are all kinds of factors involved, and it's called scaling. Typically, for a plane that's bigger, the wings are not as big proportionately than a smaller plane. And there are reasons for this. It's called scaling. On a sailboat, the hull of the sailboat, first of all, you have the hull, and then you have a big, heavy weight at the bottom of it. It's called the keel. And on the Tahiti Ketch, that keel runs the full length of the boat. Okay. And the Tahiti Ketch is a ketch where it has two masts, and what I designed was a smaller version but with a single mast. So this is a lot of changes involved here, and you have to understand the principles of scaling. First of all, the hull, when you make it two-thirds the length, all of a sudden the volume, well, let's look at it this way. The hull is a three-dimensional object. It has width and length and height, okay? And so what happens? As you make it smaller, the dimensions of the volume go as the cube of the linear dimension, whereas the sail area, when you put the sail up, it goes as the square, okay? And so anyway, what happens is you have to, now in a working model sailboat, the sail balances against the ballast. And so now you have less ballast in the hull because it's two-thirds as long. The volume of the hull is going down by two-thirds. Okay, so now what you have to do is you have to make the hull wider, proportionately wider. If you made the hull proportionately to the 30-foot boat and didn't make the 20-foot boat wider, it would tip over with the sail load that you put on it, or you'd have to adjust the sail load. And so at any rate, what I had to do was make the boat a bit wider, and these were made because of calculations. And so at any rate, then I made the sail plan was a sloop, which means there's one mast, so I had to balance the sail rig with the center line on the boat. So all of these calculations went into this, and it was a very good problem. But the point is that decades later, when I sat down in to solve the world energy problem, and I finally came up with the wing generator, all of what I learned in designing this sailboat came to fruition and were then applied to the scaling of the wing generator, which of course is my now patented, has two patents on it. The wing generator has two patents. And the topic of scaling came into play with the wing generator because my main motivation was not to design a wind system that was just a normal small one. The idea was to design something that could scale up to very large sizes. So I had this experience in scaling sailboats and also aerodynamic systems, sails, etc. And that went into play when I built, in fact, the very first wing generator that I built, and not only the first one, but a number of them, used the same sail design and fabrication techniques as that I use for the sailboats. And then my very first sailboat, which was the sailboat that I designed, the shortened Tahiti Catch, and the native fishing boat, both of them used canvas sails. And there was a sail maker there, an old guy, who made sails. That was his part of the local fishing business, was making the sails. And so I watched him work. I saw what he did. I saw how he put the rope in, would sew by hand the sails into the rope so that the rope had the strength to define the shape of the sail, how the sails were cut. And it's not, you think, well, a sail is just a flat piece of canvas like a sheet. No, it has a cut to it so that it makes an airfoil. And so I learned all of this, and all of this came back into play when I later designed and started building the wing generators. And of course, that's a patented device, and eventually that was something that helped me win an XPRIZE. I'm an XPRIZE finalist, something that probably most of you know. It's called the Water Abundance XPRIZE, and that occurred in the year 2018. But part of the design there was I used the 50 kilowatt wing generator and water from the air machines, which were also from my company, then formed the JMCC Wing Company. And also, of course, by that time, 2018, my water filter business was in full swing, and I adapted the water from the air machines as part of my product line with a lot of innovative engineering in the product. But anyway, so the reason I'm telling you about the sailboats, because once again, somebody was saying, okay, here, you're going to spend a couple years here. It's kind of like Noah building the ark. By the way, the ark was a double ender, just to give you a little bit of information. And the reason that you know this is because when Noah was out in the ocean flopping around with this big ark, he couldn't, there was no way to turn it around relative to the wind. So he used what are known as sea anchors. They're like a parachute that you put in the ocean and on an anchor rope. And as the wind blows the ship, the sea anchor is, of course, causing a drag, and it causes the ship to always point into the wind. And this is very important because when you're out on an open ocean with a lot of wind and a lot of waves, which Noah was, you couldn't have that boat trying to turn around sideways because it would capsize. So it was very important for Noah to have a double ender so that if something happened where the wind switched and all of a sudden the waves were coming from a different direction, and if you're a sailor at all, you know that that can happen, then what Noah had was a double ender with using sea anchors. And I spent some of my radio programs a number of years ago, going through the design of Noah's Ark and how he designed it and built it. And also I learned about boat building, which helped me understand how Noah built his ark, because shipping I don't care if you're in Turkey or Greece or the Mediterranean or the Scandinavia or the Caribbean or in the Pacific Ocean, the native builders all used the same techniques. From building, it's called building by eye, like eyes, like you see from, building by eye. And what you do is you lay the keel, you lay the bow, you lay the, and these are all done by proportions. And so when you read about Noah building the ark in the Bible, they are given, it's so many cubits long, so many cubits wide, so many cubits deep. And that's all you need, because if you understand you're building a double ender, it does not have sails, it doesn't have a motor. It's a symmetrical boat, a double ender, so the front and the back are the same. Then all you need to know are the dimensions, and the wood actually bends to those dimensions once you're building it. And so anyway, I gave a lecture on how Noah built the boat, the ark, and the fact that it was low to the waterline. In other words, it did not have a lot of cabinetry or what would you call a housing above the waterline, because there was a lot of wind, and so he had to keep the deck very clear. It would have been a very clean deck, and everything was down below deck, the animals, Noah and his family, etc. And not like the one that Russell Crowe built. Maybe some of the same techniques of using tar and sealing it, etc., and hewing logs and timbers. But clearly Noah had a pre-information that the comet was coming, and he had to get this ark built and ready to float and, you know, get all the animals in it by a certain amount of time. And, of course, everybody thought he was nuts, because here he is building this major league boat out in the middle of land, in the middle of nowhere, not near an ocean or anything. And everybody thought he was nuts until it started to rain. 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain, which came from a comet. So it was clear Noah had a forewarning that this comet was coming and Earth would spend this time in the comet tail, causing these torrential rains for literally 40 days or 40 nights. And in my calculations, when Hale-Bopp was a comet in the solar system, I made a calculation that the Earth, if it had passed through the tail of Hale-Bopp, would have spent around 40 days and 40 nights in the tail, the same amount of time that Noah experienced the great flood, which was an inundation from above. It wasn't, you know, where did all this water come from? Well, it came from above. And of course, that's part of my later work also, is understanding that water, not all the water in the rain, but some rainstorms come and they develop over land, and the water is coming from outer space down the low pressure cells that are connecting into outer space. They're actually comet tails of planet Earth with water coming in and funneling all the way down to the troposphere where we live. But in the case of Noah, we were immersed in a large comet tail, and so it just rained. This water influx came from the comet tail for 40 days and 40 nights until Earth passed out of that, and then the waters receded. But it destroyed everything. The world's population before Noah was possibly bigger than it is today, and the people had basically destroyed Earth. And the comet destroyed the population of Earth. Only a few people lived through that. And we know that people up in the Hindu Kush area of India, north of India, Chinese, fared fairly well. And that's why China today has a much bigger population, because they had an earlier start than, say, the Western Hemisphere that was destroyed, had a tremendous amount of flooding. And then also a few thousand years later was the Venus event, which caused an influx of pollution on planet Earth, but it was not the devastating flooding that happened during the Noah event. Now I want to switch gears a little bit here, and I want to talk about Another experience I had when I was in those 4 years I was teaching, and that was at the university level. I was teaching physics, mathematics, computer science. And that was very important, too. And by the way, these were the 4 years that I needed. I needed this experience and that level of time, 4 years, for me to get the job at Cornell. So I was not only preparing myself for the wing generator, which came decades later, and the understanding of sail and wind and aerodynamics and scaling of aerodynamic systems, etc., but I was getting the experience teaching in a foreign language, physics, mathematics, computer science, that I needed to get the job. And they offered me the job like right away when I went to Cornell. And I've told you that story, how I went up to become a student because I happened to be in Ithaca. I was doing something else. I thought, you know, I'm going to go up to Cornell and see if I can finish getting my PhD, because I had not gotten my PhD at Tulane. I decided not to get it then, which was instrumental also. I would never have been at Cornell if I would have gotten my PhD at Tulane. And I would have never gotten the job at Cornell if I didn't have these 4 years of experience teaching physics in a foreign language. And so anyway, when I got to Cornell and I went up to become a student, they said, well, we cannot give you, we're booked up here for years in advance. We have a lot of competition. You cannot be a student, but you can teach here. And of course, I took the job and the rest is history. But it was prepping me for that moment, that day when I walked into Cornell University, that I had everything in place to get that teaching position. And so anyway, the next thing I want to talk about is something that happened. I was walking along the beach one day, and I tend to spend a lot of time in tropical places at the beach. But anyway, I'm walking along the beach one day, and I look out over the ocean, and there are two water spouts. And of course, this is going to be instrumental in me someday understanding the electrical nature of cyclonic storms like tornadoes, hurricanes, cyclones, dust devils, etc. And so I'm looking at this, and being a physicist, I'm, of course, curious just from a natural phenomena point of view, but also from a physics point of view. And I'm looking at these, and it's somewhat of a misty day. It's not cloudy. There's no clouds. It's just it's kind of like a blue sky. And this is typical in the tropical regions. If there's a lot of haze in the air, but it's not cloudy. You know, you can see the blue sky up there. But anyway, as you look out over the ocean, there's a bit of haze above the water because it's a hot day and water is evaporating off the ocean. It's a humid place. You're right off the ocean. So anyway, I'm watching these two water spouts kind of wiggle around, and they're probably about a mile high. That's my estimation. They're probably a few miles offshore, and then just to get an idea, they were probably, I mean, they were easily, you know, the better part of a mile high. And also, fishermen are famous for picking up fish as they suck water out of the ocean. They pick up fish and throw them, and there'll be fishermen going along in their boat, and all of a sudden these fish come flying out of the air. And that's what happens. They get sucked up. And so this is it's like a vacuum cleaner going up. And they're not very wide. They're very thin. They're very narrow, as opposed to a tornado, which is shorter and fatter, typically. But these water spouts are very tall, and they're kind of like, they look like a snake moving around, kind of. They're kind of undulating and moving, but they're moving along the water. And they're about maybe half a mile apart. It's hard to, you know, they're offshore, so I'm really not certain. But, you know, you as a person that's typically on the water and on a boat, you get an idea about how far away things are because of the distance between you, the amount of water between you and them. So anyway, this is probably a couple miles away. They're probably the better part of a mile tall. And they're moving along, and I'm like, what is making these things operate? What is making these water spouts, what's powering them? I mean, you don't have physical phenomenon that are energetic. I mean, they're sucking water. Now, look at the potential energy in a column of water that's a mile high. Tremendous amount of work that it takes to draw this water up this column. And where's the energy source? There isn't any. You can't see it. There's no visible energy source. If there were a cloud there, you could say, well, it's due to the cloud. Typical meteorological explanations for water spouts, tornadoes, clouds, and other phenomena, hurricanes, etc., are pretty lame. They do not address the issue of what's the energy source. Where does the energy come from to power these storms? And so, of course, at that point in my life, I did not have an answer. Just like when I saw the Quetzal bird I talked about last week flying over my head. I happened to be at sundown in this little teeny hut in the middle of the Quintana Roo jungles off the ruined site of Tulum. And I just happened to walk out there, and I happened to be standing in this woman's little kind of store in their little hut in this Lacandon village as the Quetzal bird leaves its roost above her head and flies right over my head. I mean, what's the possibility, what's the probability of that happening? And seeing a bird's eye view, literally, of the underside plumage of the Quetzal bird. I mean, what is the probability of that? It's like non-existent. A lot of people have seen water spouts, but in my later life, then when I started working on my weather work, once I realized all of the electrical ramifications, the excess current in the solar wind, the solar capacitor, that Earth is discharging the solar capacitor and is acting like a comet, and the magnetic tail of Earth is not a magnetic tail at all. It's literally the comet tail of Earth. And all of these facts, and then that the ionosphere of Earth is charged because it's part of the electrical current. And then this explains Tesla's work, because Tesla was tapping into the vertical electric field. That's what he was doing in Colorado Springs and in the Wardenclyffe Tower. And so it was to further the work of Tesla by putting a theoretical basis. See, Tesla was, before the space program or anything, he did not know about the solar wind. He didn't know where this vertical electric field that he was tapping into, he didn't know where it came from. He didn't know what caused it. He knew it was there. He knew it was around 300 volts per meter. He knew that the ground conducted electricity and that you could draw off atmospheric electricity and guide it through the ground at a certain resonant frequency. He knew all of these things, but he did not know from where this energy came from. And he was not a stupid guy. He just didn't have the wherewithal. He did not have the scientific data that I had available to me. But part of putting all this together, when I started really working on my weather work and understanding that the electrical nature of the sun is what drove Earth's weather, and it was not because of light coming in from the sun, just bogus science that they're still teaching today, absolutely bogus, that the sun causes the winds and the clouds and the hurricanes. And I mean, it's just absurd. It doesn't make sense from a physics or thermodynamics point of view, or an entropy point of view. It doesn't, the conservation of energy point of view, it doesn't make any sense at all how these storms form, etc., including water spouts. Water spouts are a form of electrical discharge. They are, and what happens is there is ionized air at the surface of the water. And once there is a break in the vertical electric field, then this current starts rising up this column, and it's rotating because of the Coriolis force, and goes up the vertical electric field, and it's a current path is what's going on, and the ions are part of that current. there's an electron current that's coming down, and that's why whenever you see a waterspout or a tornado or a dust devil, there's always a lot of electricity involved, atmospheric electricity. And so anyway, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here, and it's been a week or two since I have filled in some of the blanks here, because I was going to, if you recall, talk about what would be considered on the level of Nobel Prize-winning discoveries in my work. And so this will actually, I'll be talking about this a bit later when all my weather work came into play. But it will be one of the major discoveries, the discovery that and not only the discovery that electricity operates the weather systems, but where that energy comes from. The pattern of you take the energy from the sun, the fusion reaction, which is up in the atmosphere of the sun, not down in the core of the sun, it's up in the atmosphere, which produces the excess current of protons in the solar wind, which produces the solar capacitor. The Earth is discharging that solar capacitor, so are the other planets and the small unlit stars, Jupiter and Saturn, which causes the electrical currents and the buildup of charge around the ionosphere, which creates a vertical electric field, and it's the discharge of the Earth's vertical electric field which creates our weather, the wind storms. And then additionally, you have the co-rotating or the counter-rotating electric currents in the jet streams, basically, where the in the tropical regions and in the northern in the tropical regions around the equator, you have the electron current in the ionosphere going in a westerly direction, and then in the temperate north and southern hemisphere, you have the positive easterly moving current belts, and then up towards the poles, you have another negative belt that goes westerly. So we have a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 counter-rotating electrical belts on Earth, whereas Jupiter has like 13. Jupiter's much bigger. And so you notice that when, say, the Great Red Spot is going around, it goes in one direction, and the right next to it is a co-rotating band that goes in the other direction. And so Jupiter has many more bands than Earth does, but it's the same principle. Or if you look, for example, at the south polar region of Earth, during certain times of years, you have a hexagonal pattern with 6 rotating cyclonic storms packed together, giving you a hexagonal shape. And the same thing happens on Saturn, and this is caused by a combination of the solar wind, but primarily the discharge of the local vertical electric field of Saturn. And those storms are forming and dissipating that energy, but you have a central storm surrounded by 6 other storms and gives you this hex shape. And so anyway, that explains the weather pattern at the southern pole of Earth and of Saturn. So very interesting. And other phenomena like the electrical discharges between Io, the moon of the innermost moon of Jupiter. There's an electric current that bridges Io to Jupiter. And in all of these cases, the standard scientific explanation is backwards. They're saying that the condition, the moon Io moving through the magnetic field of Jupiter causes this arc and current, when it is totally unrelated to that. It's due to the fact that Jupiter has its own proton wind, and Io is discharging it. The same thing happens with the moon Dione of Saturn. But at any rate, I want to, there's a current event that just happened and was announced. Actually, it happened in December, last December, regarding Comet Leonard. Now, if you have listened to my shows up to last fall, I was talking about Comet Leonard. This was in, just to be specific, this would be October, November timeframe of the year 2021. I was talking about Comet Leonard and its close approach to the planet Venus, Well, it turns out that it did have a major encounter electrically with Venus. NASA and all of the standard scientific astronomical observatories are hiding the data. They have a tremendous number of observations in all different wavelengths, and they're hiding this information. But it came out that one of the solar observatories that's in moving around the sun, it actually belongs to the European Space Agency, went through the tail of Comet Leonard, and what they realized is that the tail of Comet Leonard, as it was at Venus, so this is a good distance towards the sun, and Venus was coming around for its inferior conjunction. The tail of Comet Leonard was all the way past Earth. In fact, Earth had an encounter with that tail, and that's what I was talking about. That eventually on the 4th of January, I think the 9th of January 2022 was the inferior conjunction of Venus, but on the 4th of January started the flu, what I call the Venus inferior conjunction flu. And so anyway, now it's come out and confirmed with announcements using spacecraft data of the European Space Agency satellite that actually flew through the tail of Comet Leonard, and that's what I said would happen. It would, the comet tail would become very long, and Earth could become connected to that, and that's exactly what happened. Certainly not a dirty snowball, and this is one of the great criminal activities of the standard scientific community. Is taking this data, which is instrumental to understand that comets are not dirty snowballs, hiding it so that they can protect their theory. I mean, this is criminal activity. This is jail time for these corrupt scientists who are getting government money under falsified documents and information and sequestering of data and hiding of data and basically lying, falsifying scientific papers so they can keep their funding. Okay, so at any rate, the Comet Leonard was observed with satellites to extend beyond the orbit of Earth. And once again, I'm about out of time. We'll continue this series through the entire year of 2022, talking about my past discoveries. Which ones are major discoveries of Nobel Prize level discoveries? And of course, the Nobel Prize Committee is completely owned by the New World Order. They give out ridiculous prize. It's just absolutely absurd. I won't even go into it. But anyway, so it's important to understand my work and my work history, etc. Once again, remember my web pages, jmccsci.com, and also jmccwaterfilters.com, where you still can get a 10% discount using the coupon code JMCC at the website jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.